November 27, 1950. He had gathered several of his senior commanders, allowing them to speak, to reveal their preparations, the positioning of their troops. It was his way of testing their resolve, just who among them was as prepared for what lay ahead as he was. He had few reasons to doubt them, knew that they had all absorbed what had happened to Gao, that any show of weakness could bring the same demotion to them. Already, Gao had been moved to a position far to the rear, supervising a camp of walking wounded, along with ailing troops who had fallen out, too weak to make the treacherous marches through so many of the mountain passes. Sung knew he did not have to mention Gao by name, no need to lecture them on what might happen to them if they showed that kind of weakness or hesitation. The humiliation of losing a top command, of surrendering your sword to your commanding officer, was the kind of shame these men had avoided since they were boys. Now the stakes were so much more important, all of them understanding that bringing shame on your command might mean a firing squad. But Sung had little use for that kind of theatrics. Unlike so many of the leaders he had served in the past, he did not want his camps dominated by fear. That kind of authority had been effective occasionally, when Mao had been in the field. It was Mao's way, prodding his men with both philosophy and punishment. There could be a kind of viciousness to that, a once loyal officer suddenly eliminated, the victim of his own indiscretion or perhaps a lapse in judgment. Against the Japanese and then Chang's nationalists, Mao had the advantage of his disadvantages, being outnumbered, always regrouping, where poor tactics might be catastrophic, where defeat might mean the collapse of his entire nation. Now, firmly atop China's hierarchy, it was very different. A more benevolent Mao, who had granted enormous responsibilities to his generals. The lines of communication remained, radio contact with General Peng, who would certainly relay every important piece of information to Mao himself, but Sung, like Lin Biao to the west, knew that the leash was loose. With the luxury of discretion came pressure to succeed. No one above you to shoulder the blame for failures of your command. Sung had welcomed that kind of pressure, had never doubted his own abilities, even if he suspected weakness in those beneath him. So far, they seemed to have learned the lesson handed to Gao. As the armies continued their drive southward, Sung had received instruction and counsel, mostly from General Peng, and all of it supportive. From their first day's crossing of the Yalu River, Sung had assumed there would be spying eyes, others in his command who made their own reports to Peking. But so far, Sung felt completely comfortable with his decisions and had no reason to believe that was any different in Peking. The officers who served him seemed to know that as well, a soaring morale that spread down through the ranks of the foot soldiers, even the servants and coolies going about their work with a spirit that smelled of victory. He welcomed that, as much as he encouraged it. Very soon there would be loss of life, the necessary sacrifice coming from men who would accept that as their lasting gift to Chairman Mao. Many of the men in front of him now had made their journey to his camp on the backs of ponies, a useful tool, and one more piece of living camouflage to confuse the American aircraft. The planes had come every day the weather allowed, teams of two or four or six, swooping low to target anything that could be his army. Occasionally, they were right. Many more times they dropped their bombs and threw their rockets into harmless hamlets, abandoned buildings, and farmhouses. It made for spectacular display, great fireballs, villages blasted into oblivion, while often the soldiers of Sung's army huddled in brushy fields nearby, close enough to feel the warmth of the explosions. And so both sides waited happily for the darkness. Pilots, returning to their bases, met with backslapping congratulations, while in the mountains, the Chinese rose up from their cover, following his instructions, moving one day closer to the great confrontation. They were mostly seated, some on cushions, protection from the frozen ground beneath them. Sung tried to ignore the brutality of the cold, a glance skyward, a light snowfall just beginning. He had gone over the maps, each division commander offering details of his position, the fitness of his troops, their eagerness to launch their full-out assault. Sung had held them back from any major assault far longer than even he had expected, their impatience showing through in their discussions. He listened to each man, would give them nothing yet, allowed the commanders more room than usual to express their frustration. Through all the details, so much information, he focused as much on their mood as on their troop positions. In the cold morning, with teacups quickly frozen, he eyed them carefully, searching for hints of anxiety, signs of personal suffering. "Surely they know," he thought, "that this enemy is something very new, a self-described army of United Nations, as though by their grandiose label the entire world was aligned against China." The question rolled into his brain, and he held up a hand, interrupting General Su, one of his division commanders. "I am wondering if you fear the enemy because you believe his propaganda. Do any of you believe that, because we are said to be isolated from all the world, China will crumble against the might of Western guns?" The question seemed to surprise them all, the dozen men glancing at one another, searching his words for the trick. Su laughed now, pointed a finger at Sung. "You are asking if we shall abandon the battlefield just because the Americans have larger artillery pieces. My division would not do any such thing. If I believed that they would, I would offer you my head right here." Another of the senior men spoke, General Ban, an older man, a veteran of more campaigns than Sung. "Is this a challenge, General? Must you still test the strength of our will? I would suggest that you allow our commands to answer your question for you, to engage the enemy right now. We have maneuvered and delayed. We have strengthened our positions as much as is possible. What more must we wait for? Are you holding our fists in your pocket because you lack confidence? Or is it Peking that lacks confidence?" Sung debated his response. "I have delayed attacking the enemy because every day that the enemy marches forward, he draws closer to our strongest points. He marches blindly toward his own destruction. I admit to being baffled by their foolishness, and I wonder about the power of their propaganda, that they consider it a wise strategy to convince their fighting men that, merely by their presence in Korea, they inspire such terror in their enemies that we shall flee before them." Another man spoke. "We shall not flee at all. Like General Su, I await the order to attack. My men are eager for the fight." Sung nodded, put his hands out as though calming them. "This is very good," he thought. "Exactly what I was hoping for. I am satisfied with your reports. Word of your efficiency shall be passed back to Peking." To one side, a man stood. Chow Lin, an older man who commanded the 60th Division.
"Permit me, sir."
"Yes? You wish to add something?"
"I regret that one of my regiments was careless and suffered the loss of several prisoners to the Americans."
"When?"
"Within the past 4 days. I have taken appropriate steps to punish the officer in charge. I assure you it will not happen again."
Sung waited for the man to seat himself, said,
"Of course it will happen again. We shall capture a good many of their side, as they will capture ours. No one in this army has been ordered to die to the last man. The American soldiers do not understand that.
Not at all. They have been told that we are a fanatical race, that we are little more than a form of animal life. It is a part of being Western, that astonishing arrogance, their belief in their own superiority. I have seen it in their literature, and more important, I see it every day in their strategy. Even now, they continue to advance farther into our strongest positions and farther away from their base of supply. I marvel at the willingness of the American Marines to do our work for us. And now they have created vast supply depots within our very position, which we will use to great advantage. In front of him, General Hsu rose. Sir, I mean no disrespect, but you have not told us anything of when we may begin our primary assault. Every day we observe them, it increases our eagerness. The weather is becoming difficult. There are reports every day of men who are too stricken with frostbite to be effective. Can you tell us when we are to join the attack? Sung stood with his hands inside his coat, pulled them out now, held a piece of paper. First, General Bon, commanding the 27th Army, confirms that American Marines have vacated their forward positions on the east side of the reservoir and have been replaced by American Army troops from the American 7th Division. General Bon is as anxious as any of you to begin his assault. Like you, he has been ordered to wait and observe. That has proven to be of benefit. I do not believe the American Army units are capable of resisting us. That, however, is not the most important information. He made a show of pushing the paper into his coat, then nodded toward his aide. Colonel Liu, you may have the honor of reading the dispatch received this morning. Liu stood, had been prepared for this, produced another piece of paper, read slowly. To General Sung Shilun, commanding, 9th Field Army Group. On November 25th, the 13th Field Army Group launched a significant assault against the greatest concentration of American and Korean troops west of the Taibek Mountains. This assault was executed with precision and expertise and was entirely successful. All sections of the American 8th Army and associated Korean units are in a full retreat. The 13th Army Group is following this victory with an aggressive pursuit, which shall succeed in destroying the enemy invaders. Chairman Mao Zedong offers the people's gratitude to our heroic soldiers who have accomplished this victory. Chairman Mao believes that this success should serve as high example to the soldiers of the 9th Army Group as you begin your valiant assault. Your goal, as communicated to your commander, is to destroy the American Marine 1st Division, the American 7th Army Division, the American 3rd Army Division, and all associated Korean Army units of the puppet government. The people salute your efforts. Liu, kept at attention, looked at Sung with a short nod. In front of Sung, the commanders received the news with wide-eyed surprise, stunned expressions. In front of Sung, General Hsu said, "Are we certain of this?" Sung expected that response, said, "This dispatch was received through highest channels and is marked with the sign of Chairman Mao's own hand." He paused. "I am certain." He allowed them a moment longer, smiles now breaking out, the men turning again to him, the silent question on their faces. He held up his hand, quieting them, said, "Chairman Mao has imparted this lesson to me, and I shall impart it to you. Enemy advancing, we retreat. Enemy entrenched, we harass. Enemy exhausted, we attack. Enemy retreating, we pursue. We have accomplished the first task with perfection. You have all expressed your eagerness to begin the attack. It is now time. By midnight tonight, you will advance your troops into direct confrontation with the enemy forces in your front. You will hold nothing back. If the enemy holds his position, you will attack again until he breaks. When he breaks, you will pursue with the single purpose of destroying him. We shall demonstrate to Chairman Mao just how completely you have learned his teachings. It is time for us to destroy our enemies.
I must say, very exciting. I had wondered myself just how long you could merely watch the Americans pass by your guns.
Sung scooped a single stick of cold rice into his mouth, warmed it for a long moment, made a difficult swallow.
Major Orloff, if you have questions, you may ask them directly. You may not approve of the answer, but I hide nothing from you.
I tried a piece of your dried fish this morning. There isn't much else in the camp that resists the cold. I saw one of your aides chewing a piece of rice paper.
Sung slid the stick into the small pile of dense rice, bent low, scooped the rice into his mouth, repeated the same routine. Another half-choking swallow.
We shall endure, as we shall prevail.
Orloff pulled his small bottle from his coat, took a drink.
I believe you call that the party line. Your Chairman Mao is quite adept at the poetry of war.
There is nothing wrong with inspiring the soldiers to do their duty.
Orloff put a gloved hand to his face, brushed at snow on his hat.
So you inspire a man's mind while his feet suffer a painful death. I was at one of your hospitals this morning. I suppose you would call it that. There was a man there behaving like a doctor. You had at least 30 men laid out like frozen trees, 30 more who still had enough life in them so they could scream.
You were in Leningrad. You know what cold can do, what kind of challenges it holds.
Orloff pulled at his coat, blew a foggy breath into his hands.
This is not Leningrad. We had snow and ice and the kind of suffering that no man should see. Here, there is death in the air, pushing into a man's lungs. There is death on the ground, beneath your feet. There is no protection, no sanctuary. Look at you. You cannot eat your meal without struggling with frozen rice. There is no tea to be had. Boiling water freezes in seconds. If you drank spirits, you would at least warm yourself from the inside.
Sung put the bowl aside, ignored the harsh rumble in his stomach.
What would you suggest, Major? We all go home? Is that what you told your officers years ago? I am cold. I am suffering. I cannot fight. This is too difficult.
Orloff breathed again into his glove.
And they would have shot me, as you would shoot your own.
Sung was annoyed.
Do not assume I am Russian, Major. We help our soldiers as we are able. Once the attack begins, they will no longer notice the cold.
Can't you at least provide them with boots?
Sung paced slowly, a hard breeze ripping into his furry coat. He tried to hide the effect of that, said,
You are supposed to observe, not criticize. The footwear we use is meant for stealth. It is one of the few advantages we have, the ability to approach our enemies discreetly, to attack at night, at close range. The soldiers know that. They are prepared to do what we must do to prevail. We do not have the luxury of fine radios, and so we must communicate with sound, with the bugles and cymbals and whistles. Every regimental commander has his own signals, and his men have been trained to recognize that. I should not have to provide you a lesson in tactics.
He was angry now, watched as Orloff retrieved the bottle again. He tried to keep Orlov's observations at a distance, knew of the horrors of the field hospitals. In the past, he had visited them often, comforting wounded men, offering them the gratitude befitting their heroics. But there were no heroics now. Not yet. Every man crippled by the cold, just one more bullet lost, reducing the strength of Sung's army.
Are you concerned about the prisoners? I heard your General Chow. You seem to dismiss his concerns about losing a few men to the Americans. I would be concerned about intelligence, that the Americans might gain some valuable information.
I am not concerned at all. For weeks now we have lost prisoners. This is a proud army, and pride compels men to boast of all they know. How has that changed, this fight? I have 12 divisions in these mountains. I outnumber my enemy by a factor of 5 to 1, perhaps more. If the Americans are aware of that, why do they come? They must believe that we are a mirage, an army of ghosts.
Or they believe it doesn't matter how many men you have. The Americans in particular, they believe they are invincible.
Sung nodded.
Precisely. And tonight we shall prove to them that ghosts can kill, and that the confidence of their generals is a sad mistake.
Chapter 21. Riley. Hagaru Ri, November 27, 1950. For the past few days, the Chinese seemed to wake up, slipping closer, the skirmishes more intense. An even greater concern was the occupation of a tall hill a short mile up the road toward their next objective, Yudam Ni. It had fallen on Baker Company to push the Chinese away from the vantage point that could have decimated any convoy attempting to travel up the main supply road. After a sharp and brief fight, the Marines gained control of the hill, the Chinese then doing what they had done all along. They disappeared. Even before Thanksgiving, the orders had come from Litzenberg that once Baker Company had secured the big hill, more of the 7th would move up that way, advancing northward along the west side of the reservoir. But the orders continued to come. More men from the 5th moving out that way as well, no one explaining to the men of Fox Company just what those men had been ordered to do. For now, the mission of Fox Company had not changed, instructions to serve as a security force. As was typical, the griping came, assumptions that Fox was being punished for some indiscretion, or worse, that Captain Barber himself had asked to have his men passed over for any of the more important tasks. Riley had no idea what to believe, and like the others, he knew only what the officers told him. But even Lieutenant McCarthy was grumbling, low comments, suspicious of the captain. The orders finally came for Fox to follow in the tracks of the others, but still, no one above them offered any satisfactory explanation as to just where they were supposed to go. The scuttlebutt only grew louder when the men observed Captain Barber and the battalion commander, Colonel Lockwood, moving out in a lone jeep. What McCarthy told them was a scouting mission, though the men still grumbled that no one was sure just what the officers were scouting. Their gear had been stowed, the backpacks assembled, the men gathering, checking their weapons, cursing the cold that made cleaning a rifle impossible. Riley did as he often did, marched in place, a vain effort to keep his feet thawed. Around him, others were doing the same, waiting impatiently for the order to move. He saw Lieutenant McCarthy now, and Killian was there, his loud tone piercing even the bustling wind.
"Hey, Lieutenant, how come we gotta walk? There's trucks all over the place."
"If they tell me, I'll tell you. All I know is that Captain Barber went forward with Colonel Lockwood scouting out the road. The colonel came back, but the captain's still out there. Wherever he is now, that's where we're going. If there were trucks for us, we'd have 'em."
McCarthy moved away, and Killian saw Riley. Moved closer to him, said,
"You'd think as newfangled as we're supposed to be, they'd have a decent way to move us around. My damn feet are already wet. I got spare socks stuck in places I ain't telling you where. And I was writing a letter to Colleen, and had to put it up halfway through. I'm still carrying a turkey leg in my coat that one day might thaw out enough for me to eat it."
Riley saw the chaplain, Craven, moving through the men, welcomed the break from Killian's belly aching.
"Hello, chaplain. I guess we're moving north after all."
"Howdy, boys."
"Yep, count on that. I got it pretty solid that we're headed all the way to the Yalu River."
Killian tugged at his backpack, hoisted it over his shoulders, said,
"I tell you what, I'm holding on to my pea, and when we get there, I'm unloading it all into that river. Let those shambos know I've been there."
Riley looked at Craven, wasn't sure how the man would react. The chaplain was smiling at Killian's bluntness, said,
"Well now, Private, you do that if it pleases you. I'd rather like kneeling down beside that water and saying a prayer that the Chinese pull out of this war so we can all go home."
Craven smiled, nodded toward Riley, moved away. Killian stared after him, said in a low voice,
"Figures. Even those Bible fellas pull rank on you."
Riley ignored Killian, pondered Craven's words. "He said we're going to the Yalu. Captain sure as hell ain't gone that far. You think the Chinese are just going to let us stroll up there without saying something about it?"
"Who cares? We find the shambos, we'll bust them up."
Killian looked around.
"Not sure how quick we're moving. Maybe I can finish this damn letter."
He hustled off, and Riley shivered, the cold eating through his clothing. He marched in place again, saw Lockwood moving toward his jeep, others with him wrapped in bundles of green. Riley was surprised, thought, "Don't see him all that much. Now he's all over the place." They gathered at the jeep, a brief discussion. Riley eased closer, but the talk ended, Lockwood suddenly moving toward him. Lockwood dropped the blanket, yanked his coat closed, an obvious shiver, seemed to make a show of sharing their discomfort. More men were gathering, most of the company, officers calling them forward. Lockwood said,
"Here, men, Fox Company."
Lockwood seemed miserable, pulling at his own coat, stomping his feet, and after a long moment he said,
"All right, here's the story. Captain Barber is up ahead in the Toktong Pass, waiting for us to join him. The hills there make a bottleneck. The main supply road narrow as hell. It has been confirmed that this company has been ordered to occupy a strong position overlooking the road, to act as security for the rear of the rest of the regiment, and to protect any supply convoys moving north. Captain Barber and I have located that position, some 4 miles this side of Udom Ni. The march will cover approximately 7 miles.
There were audible groans, and Lockwood seemed annoyed.
"I'll not listen to that. I've gone to great lengths, pulled a few strings, made some promises I likely can't keep, but we've got 9 trucks pulling up here in a few minutes."
There were different murmurs now, and McCarthy stepped forward.
Sir, we were told we had to prepare to move on foot. We were not aware we could ride."
"Of course you'll ride. I take care of my boys. We've got a pair of heavy machine guns joining us and a squad of 81 mortars, too, just for a little more pop. I intend for you to hold that hill, and to protect anyone who moves past it."
"That's it. Prepare to mount up."
Riley felt energized, watched Lockwood climb back into the jeep. "He's okay," he thought. "Sounds like it, anyway." Welch moved up beside him, said,
"I guess he set us straight. We're doing guard duty while the rest of the boys hunt down the enemy. What do you think of that?"
"Not sure. They wouldn't send us up there if it wasn't necessary. Chinese could be anywhere, so everybody keeps saying. But Jesus, it's cold. Sure glad we'll be riding."
Welch pulled the hood of his parka tight around his face.
"Yeah, maybe. You're right about the cold, and we ain't fighting this war from the back of trucks. I'm wondering about the captain.
What about him?
He's out there by himself on some hill holding the fort until we get there. I guess he thinks if he has to, he can take on the Chinks all by himself.
Tuktong Pass, November 27th, 1950. The truck ride had been grindingly slow, the convoy delayed by more vehicles in front of them, no one pushing too quickly on the twisting mountain road. Riley tried to settle back into his coat, appreciated the warmth of the cluster of men. Beside him, Killian said,
"We're a sad-looking bunch. No wonder Barbara hates us. We've been volunteered for latrine duty, I bet. Dig out these slit trenches for the rest of the corps."
On the other side of Killian, Welch said,
"Bull. We're going into action. They loaded us up with ammo, and there's more trucks behind us. The colonel's leading us up there, and he wouldn't be riding along if it wasn't important."
Riley looked past Killian, caught a glimpse of Welch beneath the hood. "Since when did you get so much respect for the brass?"
Killian said, "He's bucking for Second Louis. Talk nice about the officers and they make you one. The reason the colonel's up there is he's the only one here who knows where we're supposed to go. I bet Captain Barber's up on his hillside cussing up a blue storm wondering where the hell we are. I bet he's got a bonfire going bigger than this truck."
Riley leaned back against the hard side of the truck, had no interest in getting into some meaningless argument with Killian. Welch said,
"They ought to put you in charge. You got it all figured out."
At the rear of the truck, a face appeared, the man climbing up with a heavy grunt, standing tall. Morelli said,
"Hey, sir, you better hang on. Truck starts moving. You'll be on your rear end. Happened to me more than once."
"Thank you, son. They tell me we'll be a few minutes yet. There's some artillery up ahead, and they need some time to get them around a sharp turn. I'm Orville Hayes, Associated Press. I don't believe I've spoken to you gents yet. Third platoon, eh? How are we doing?"
Riley recognized the man now, had seen him around Hagaru Ree, poking his curiosity into any place the officers would allow. Riley had no particular disdain for reporters, but there was something highly counterfeit about this man's concerns. Riley, as suspicious as many of the others that what he really wanted was some kind of negative poop about the brass or maybe the war itself. The man pulled out a small pad of paper, fumbled with a pencil through thickly gloved fingers. Killian pointed to Riley, said,
"Hey, talk to this one here. He loves reporters. Got some great stories. A real hero, all of that."
Riley pulled himself deeper into his coat, but the man took the bait, leaned low, a gust of sour breath into Riley's face.
"Outstanding. How you doing, Marine? Don't think I have spoken to you as yet. Hate to miss anyone. I assume all of you fellows know I'm trying to gather up as much as I can to send back home."
Riley glanced down at his boots, thought, one sharp kick right into Killian's crotch. Remember that. I owe him one.
He identified the odor, sour cigar smoke, cutting even through the harsh cold of the frigid air. He saw Welch leaning forward, looking at him with an evil smile, others in the truck speaking out now, confirming what Killian had said.
"Yep, he's your man, sir. Fights barehanded. Don't even need a rifle. Toughest hombre in the platoon. I'm scared of him for sure."
The exaggerated goofiness seemed contagious, the men welcoming something to laugh about. Riley thought, maybe I should play the part and grab this idiot by the throat. Hayes put a hand on Riley's shoulder, said,
"Quite a character, eh? Excellent. So where are you from, son?"
Riley tried to avoid the man's breath. "Pennsylvania? Small town near Harrisburg."
"Excellent. Amish country. Your family Amish, then?"
Riley could feel the oiliness of the man's artificial enthusiasm, heard a chuckle from Welch. Riley said,
"Not too many Amish Marines, sir."
Well, yes, that does make sense. It would make a hell of a story, though. Hayes laughed, coughed in the sharp, cold air. Tell me, son, you have a family back home? How'd you like to give them a rousing cheerio, let them know you're doing fine?
I write my wife pretty often. That's good enough.
Yes, well, that's fine. Hayes paused, a wet cough blowing out into a fog of steam. You know, your Colonel Lockwood has authorized me to be out here. I was told you boys would cooperate. I don't mean to be a bother, but I do have a job to do.
Sorry, sir. I don't hear much that comes direct from the Colonel. Guess I just don't have much to say.
Well, let me ask you, son. What's the one thing you wish for out here? The one thing you wish you had?
Riley thought a moment, the comments growing quiet, the others more serious now, waiting for his response. The question dug through him, stirred something unexpected, emotions he tried to push away. After a long, cold minute, he said, I want to see tomorrow.
Hayes didn't respond, and Riley tried to ignore him, avoided the thoughts of everything he was missing, of everything that could happen to him. Hayes stared at him for a long moment, then said, Thank you, Marine.
The silence hung in the air for another long second, all eyes on Riley, who closed his, pulling himself away. The silence was broken by the voice of Killian.
Here's what I want. Write this down. Dry feet, warm feet. A steak, my dog, my wife, my Packard, my wife again, another steak, my bed, my fireplace, maybe my wife again, pork chops, a baked potato with gravy, another steak.
The trucks continued their slow progress, climbing, twisting, halting. The reporter was long gone, and Riley wondered if he enjoyed the job, if poking his questions into the faces of fighting men was fun. Has to be interesting, he thought. I guess those fellows got to keep their heads down, too. He thought of Ernie Pyle, killed near Okinawa, shot down by a Japanese machine gun. Riley never saw Pyle, but knew men who did, who reacted to the reporter's death as a personal tragedy. This guy's not anything like Pyle, pretty sure of that, but he's got a job to do, too, like the rest of us. And if he's out here freezing his ass off, give him credit for being something besides a coward. I bet he knows plenty of reporters sitting fat and happy in Tokyo. I should have talked to him. Not like Killian's stupidity. Maybe he'd mention me. Make sure Ruthie would see it. He glanced down to his boots, the ground-in filth on his pants legs. Nope, don't really need her to hear about any of this. Let's just get this over with. The truck began to move, swung around a sharp turn, and Riley could see a narrow valley, a flat plain between two massive hills. There was a row of small shacks, a narrow field hemmed in by a collapsing fence. He eyed the shacks, instinct, but he thought, most likely, no one's home. It had been that way along every road outside of the bigger towns, since they had begun to climb north of Sudong. He was used to it now, the focus solely on just where the enemy might be. If somewhere on the vast hills there were Chinese eyes watching them pass by, big, fat American trucks, big, fat targets. Any civilians were just in the way, an inconvenience. And Riley thought of that now. If the Chinese felt the same way. They can't just shoot them, he thought. The Japs did some of that. Solve their problem by exterminating the pests. Exterminated some of us, too, the POWs. Can't say we didn't return the favor once in a while. He avoided those memories. Every engagement bringing a scattering of prisoners and nearly always those men in his unit who took out their revenge. War crimes. That's what the reporters kept saying. Nobody asked if we were doing it, too.
That guy Hayes didn't ask anything like that. I don't want to see that stuff in the paper. Sure as hell don't want my wife seeing it. The truck was moving more quickly now, bone-jarring thumps, and Riley stared out past McCarthy, the truck in another tight turn, another truck coming into view behind them. Morelli caught his eye, the red-cheeked, cheerful face, the kid pointing outside. The Koreans must go into the towns when winter comes. Not much to do out here. Riley closed his eyes, waited for it, and, finally, Killian obliged.
Yep, that's it, kid. It's a hotel I've heard about. The Nooks are working heavy construction up in Yalu City, getting ready for our big liberation Christmas party.
You think so? Really?
The laughter drifted through the truck, Killian the loudest.
No, you moron. They're up there in these hills, aiming their rifles at us. Can't you feel it?
Morelli was embarrassed into silence now, and Riley knew the redness on his face was more than the cold. He laughed to himself, thought,
"You'll figure it out, kid." We all did.
The truck jerked to a halt again, a new burst of griping. McCarthy leaned out through the canvas, and Riley heard voices outside. The lieutenant dropped to the ground, a quick conversation. Then he called back into the truck.
Let's go. Ride's over. We found the captain. It's time to walk.
Chapter 22. Riley. Tok Tong Pass, November 27th, 1950.
Good God, I didn't train for this. Where's the damn beach?
Riley tried to ignore Killian, raised one foot in front of the other, gaining elevation with each step. Most of the men were silent, moving up the steep slope, all of them too aware what sweating could do. Behind him, Killian huffed along, while Welch led the squad alongside the others, all three of Fox Company's platoons making the climb off the main road. At the base of the hill, Captain Barber's aides were raising a tent alongside a pair of dilapidated shacks. Just above the shacks, the hill jutted sharply upward for several yards, where the road itself had been carved out of the hillside. Above that, the slope was not as severe, but for men weighed down with their weapons and equipment, the going was slow, methodical, the officers keeping the pace. Through the first part of the climb, there were trees, firs and pines wrapping the lower half of the wide hill, the men pushing up through the timber, using the tree trunks for support. But halfway up, the trees gave way to rocky ground, low scrub brush, what Riley had seen on most of the hills in this part of Korea. And without the shelter of the trees, there was nothing to hold back the wind. Riley glanced up the hill, navigated his way behind Welch, cutting through small rocks, the brush too short to serve as a handle. The trees were well behind them now, and Riley could see the rest of the 240 men, three columns spread out across the face of the hill, mostly faceless men, their hoods pulled tight, protection against the increasing torment from the wind. Behind him, Killian swore again.
I'm filing a complaint. They pulled me out of the Mediterranean to be here. I ain't no damn mountain climber.
In front of Riley, Welch turned, breathing in heavy bursts.
You bitch one more time, and I'll roll you down this damn hill so's you can climb it again. You read the same damn brochure we all did. Now shut the hell up.
Killian was silenced, Welch climbing again. The slope was easier now, the men reaching the summit, and Riley could see across most of that, a wide span spreading over several acres. The other platoons were gathering, receiving instructions from Captain Barber, the lieutenants passing along just what they were supposed to do. Riley stopped, tried to catch his breath, one hand over his mouth, filtering the frigid air from his lungs. He moved again, keeping up with the others, climbed the last ridgeline, a ragged spine that sliced through the center of the hilltop. Far beyond that, he could see another hill, taller, more rugged, connected to their position by a narrow saddle at least 200 yards long. Except for that one land bridge, the dome of the hill dropped away into a steep slope in every direction.
Third platoon, move out this way.
Riley saw McCarthy waving them forward, one arm extended, the men following the order, a single-file line along the ridge. They slogged through a patch of dense brush, the hilltop more rugged than the slopes they had climbed.
First squad, right here. Sergeant Welch, arrange your men with a field of fire out that way. The company's forming a wide horseshoe on top of this hill, with both ends terminating down at the road we just left. The captain's command post is there, and he's positioning the mortar teams just uphill from his tent. First platoon is the right flank of the horseshoe. Second is to the left. We're the middle. Your squad will be on our left flank. The other two squads will be to your right. There will be a heavy machine gun position on our right, linking us to 1st Platoon. There's some heavy brush and some pretty rough ground between us, so keep in mind where they are. No blind shooting. You need anything from those boys, talk to Lieutenant Dunn. He owes me a dozen favors, so don't be afraid to ask.
McCarthy paused, and Riley saw what seemed to be nervousness, McCarthy laboring to breathe. A new gust of wind swirled up around them, the men huddling closer, Riley moving in with them. He knew there would be more to the instructions, his brain trying to map out just what had led the captain up this particular hill, just why they were here at all. McCarthy scanned the horizon, said,
"Dark in a few. I'm betting on snow. The captain's thermometer said 12 below zero, but that's down at the road. This wind is pretty nasty, and it won't get any better, so it's going to be a long night. Find some kind of cover, any place that might break up the wind, but keep all eyes to the front. We're in a circle, everybody protecting each other's asses, even if you can't see them. That's it for now. The captain's probably on the radio to somebody in Hagaru Re, letting them know we're here. He'll be up here soon, checking our positions. Pretty sure of that."
Welch said, "How about a small fire, sir? Maybe heat up some rations?"
"The wind might make that tough, but the captain's people said they were lighting a big damn bonfire at their CP, so there's no reason we can't heat up our chow. Find a low spot well back of the crest. Once it's dark, it's lights out. No need to advertise we're up here. You can bet the enemy's out there somewhere, and they've got eyes in the dark, no matter how careful we are. Our job is to keep the enemy off that road and make damn sure that if he tries to cut us off from Hagaru Re, we make his life miserable. We're the back door to 10,000 Marines. I don't want anybody pushing us out of the way."
There was a rumble from the road below, and Riley looked that way, saw a line of vehicles, a half-dozen 6x trucks. He said, "Sir, they sending us more men?" McCarthy stared down the long hill, said,
"Not hardly. That's what we're here to protect. Supply convoys hauling it up to Udomni. We lose any of those fellows, and Colonel Litzenberg will have our asses. You know your job. Now do it."
McCarthy moved away, followed by the other two squad leaders. Welch turned to the rest of the men now, said,
"You heard him. This looks like solid rock, so pile up some kind of windbreak if you can. There's a low place right over here, behind that rock. I'll try to get some kind of fire going. We've got a half hour before it's dark, so if you want a tin can heated up, pay attention. Time to change your socks, too."
A harder gust rolled over the hillside, a blast of cold that ripped into Riley's coat. He shook a hard, uncontrollable shiver, said, "This wind is a pain in the ass. All we need now is snow so we can write home how pretty it is." Killian dropped his backpack, sat heavily, began to work on removing his boots.
"Too cold to snow. Learned that back home. It gets down below 20 degrees or so, you got nothing to worry about."
Welch ignored him, went to work with the others in the squad, guiding them into the best position there seemed to be. Riley stood immobile, too chilled to move. He eyed a small flat rock, crouched down onto his knees, pushed one hand on the hard ground, turned stiffly, and sat down. Immediately the cold from the frozen ground began driving up through the seat of his pants, and he kept his head down, the parka tight around his face. He fumbled with the boots, the cold numbing his fingers, his toes too numb to feel anything at all. There was a dusty cloud coating his gloves,
blowing into his eyes, and he brushed it away. But the dust came more heavily now, and he realized it wasn't dust at all. It was snow. He looked at Killian, the man rubbing his toes, a fresh pair of socks in his hands.
"Hey, weatherman, one more thing you're an expert about."
Killian glanced up, winced, shook his head.
"Stupid Shambo snow. Not my fault they got such crazy-ass weather."
Riley pulled his brain into gear, focused on the task at hand, each movement agonizing, the stiffness spreading through him. He tugged at his wet socks, barefooted now, his hands rubbing briskly, drying, a feeble attempt to bring any warmth at all. He tried to wriggle his toes, massaged them roughly, fumbled with a fresh pair of socks, his hands shaking as he pulled them on. He slid the boots on with an urgent tug, kept his toes in motion, fought the stinging pain. He flexed his fingers, jammed his hands inside his coat, fought to breathe, his heart pounding. Killian grunted out loud, yanking on his boots, and Riley saw the snow forming a light blanket on the man's coat. He looked up at Riley, held up his socks.
"Frozen solid already. They'll crack in half, I bet. What kind of idiot came up with this place anyway?"
Riley tried to control his shivering, said,
"I'll agree with you on that one."
The wind blew harder, a sharp groan emerging from Riley's misery, and he turned slightly, saw Welch behind the single rock, struggling with a small fire. Leave it to him, he thought, the only man in this company who can build a fire in a gale. Welch had gathered a pile of small sticks, other men now bringing him larger branches, pieces of a broken supply crate. The flames were barely visible, the smoke whisked away quickly by the relentless wind. Welch knelt low, hovering over the fire, protecting his work, more sticks coming up, adding to the glow. Riley thought of his rations, a can of beef stew he had carried optimistically for more than a week. Maybe now's the time, he thought. "I'm going to try to thaw out my chow. The sarge has done a good job."
"Yeah, I got some stew here somewhere. Kind of tired of eating Tootsie Rolls 10 times a day. Hey, who's that?"
Riley followed Killian's stare, saw a hooded figure coming toward them from the low ground. More men were trailing behind, several ammo carriers, each one hauling a pair of steel boxes. The first man reached the high ground, looked their way, moved closer, pulled back the hood of his coat, slapped his hands together. It was Captain Barber.
"Who's lighting that fire?"
Welch stood slowly, a show of reluctance, the wind smothering the low flames.
"Sergeant Welch, sir. Until it's dark, the lieutenant and me figured it can't hurt. We can heat our rations."
"It's dark enough, Sergeant. Douse that. You got more important work to do. I want the men to dig in. Prepare foxholes."
To one side, Riley saw McCarthy approaching, his face showing an indiscreet display of wide-eyed fury.
"Prepare with what, sir? We got no TNT up here. This ground's solid rock, or ice. Either way, no arguments, Lieutenant. We expecting an attack, sir?
I don't know what to expect, but we need to be ready for anything that happens. They just ran a phone wire to my CP from down at Huggaroo Ree, so at least for now we've got communications with Colonel Lockwood. They're nervous as hell about this road. If it gets cut, they're in a world of hurt. Our job is pretty clear, at least for now. Anybody besides Marines moves on that road or through these hills, blow 'em to hell."
The sound of trucks came again, and Barber looked down that way.
"This could go on all night, or until the enemy tries to stop it. As narrow as the pass is along this hill, it's exactly the place he'll try. Get working. Once the holes are dug, go to 50% watch. You hear me, Lieutenant?"
"Loud and clear, sir."
Barber pulled his hood up, marched away toward the second platoon. McCarthy stood silently, the griping rising up around him in a wind-blown chorus.
"Shut the hell up! Shovels out and get those holes dug!"
McCarthy looked toward Welch, eyed the remnants of the small fire. Riley moved up closer, thought, "Just a minute to warm my damn hands." The lieutenant glanced back toward Barber, seemed to wait for the right moment, then leaned closer to Welch, said,
Sergeant, I've got a can of beans I'd really like to eat. If you're going to build a fire, do a better job of keeping it hidden. From the enemy, that is. You've got 20 minutes, so make it work. The rest of us? Christ. We've got to chop ice.
Welch dropped low, huddling over the still-smoking branches, went to work again. McCarthy looked at Riley, the others, the men staring at him with painful disbelief.
You heard the captain. Make use of those shovels. Nobody sleeps up here until the job is done, then 50% watch. And keep your feet dry.
He paused.
God help us all.
Fox Hill, November 27th, 1950. It was nearly 9 o'clock, the griping still flowing through the position in a steady chorus of swearing, made even worse by McCarthy prowling through the position, testing their alertness. There had been passwords given, which McCarthy expected to be acknowledged, a common precaution at night. But the men were struggling with their labor, or if the holes seemed adequate, they had collapsed into sleep almost immediately. McCarthy's efforts at testing their response to the password most often resulted in a cascade of swearing from the lieutenant and several helmets thumped by the butt of his carbine. Riley had caught his own share of McCarthy's wrath, his brain struggling to stay focused on chiseling the rock-hard ground. Gradually, the hole began to take shape, the shovel clanking hard, chiseling splinters of dirt and rock, Killian working just as hard beside him. Riley stopped, a brief second's rest, said, "This is stupid as hell. We're down a whole foot. It's going to take us all night, and then you can bet tomorrow they'll haul us off somewhere else." Killian kept working, said, "Hey, it's getting easier. We get down below the frozen stuff. It's not bad. Come on, keep digging." Riley wrapped stiff fingers around the short handle of the shovel, chopped down, solid impact on a hidden rock. The shovel bounced up, sharp, stinging pain in his hands. Killian paused, said, "Try not to hit the rocks. It's better in the dirt, moron." Riley saw a smile. The Irishman's face red, streaked with filthy sweat. "If you're going to give me grief, at least pass along some of that Irish whiskey."
"Forget it. Ran out the first hour I had it. No help from the rest of you."
Riley jabbed the shovel down, a scoop of dirt, poured it in front of the hole. "We get out of this alive, and I bet we'll laugh like hell about it. One day, over drinks in some posh club in God knows where, nobody'll believe us." Killian tossed up more dirt. The deeper ground softening, said,
"Yeah, we'll be telling war stories to our grandkids. They won't believe a damn word. Where's that jackass reporter? Ought to have him up here. Maybe take pictures."
Riley jabbed his shovel down, more of the dirt coming up, the hole deepening more quickly. "Pile it up to the front side. Give us cover if we need it." Killian dropped down into the hole, dug again, said,
"There you go, acting like an officer again. That's what I've been doing all along, genius. Okay, it's about 2 feet deep. That ought to be enough."
Welch was there now. A quick exam, said,
"Good. Captain can't gripe about this one. We found some old holes dug down the face of the hill a ways. This place must have been a chink position, and they left them behind for us. That either means they hauled their rice bags out of here, or they left those holes on purpose, so they'd know where to find us."
Welch looked at Killian.
"One of you go help out Morelli. He's got a bum shovel. Kane's to your right, and I checked the 30-gun to our left. They're fixed mostly out that way, so anything straight to our front is up to you."
Riley felt the sweat on his back growing colder, said,
"I'll help the kids, Sarge. Sean can clean up this thing, make it cozy. I could use some damn sleep."
Welch pointed.
"Yeah, better you than this idiot Irishman. He's that way, 20 yards. The rest of the squad's in pretty good shape. Not sure what we're expecting to happen, but the lieutenant said the brass is too damn nervous about the road. Not really sure why the chinks couldn't just go around us. All they have to do is put a few machine guns and a half dozen mortars on that taller hill over there, and there's not much we can do about it."
To one side, the voice of McCarthy.
"Sergeant Welch! Here!"
McCarthy was there now, held out his carbine.
"Check your weapon.
Mine's frozen stiff. The gun oil's turned to glue. The M1s don't seem to be as bad. Where's your BAR?
Welch pointed, said,
Kane's over there, 10 yards. Let's check it out. Can't afford to lose the best weapon we've got.
Welch followed the lieutenant, and Riley moved out with them. Saw Morelli's meager foxhole, another man struggling to help. Riley knelt down, said,
You get a little deeper, it gets easier.
Morelli stared at him, trying to see his face, said,
That you, Pete?
Of course it's me. Who's your helper?
The other man stopped digging, sat on the edge of the hole, seemed to welcome the break.
It's Norman, Pete. We've got it. His shovel just fell to pieces. Must be some old army piece of crap.
You got this, then?
Norman said, Can you spare the shovel? The kid needs the exercise.
Riley handed the shovel to Morelli. Could tell he was shivering, his words in a chatter.
Thanks, Pete. You'll get it back.
I better.
Morelli dropped the shovel, and Riley could see him fumble to retrieve it, his hand shaking. He put a hand on Norman's shoulder.
You get done here. I'd get him into his bag pretty quick.
The sergeant already told me. We're about finished. I'll take care of him. You worry about Irish over there. Riley turned, saw Killian standing tall in front of the foxhole, realized now the snow had stopped, a hint of moonlight reflecting off the thin carpet of white.
Riley moved that way, saw that Killian had no coat.
What the hell's wrong with you?
Drying off. Best way, the wind gets rid of the sweat in a couple of minutes.
It'll get rid of you, too. Get in the damn hole.
Killian kept his pose, arms outstretched, and Welch was there now, said,
Oh, for Christ's sakes, he's bucking for the company's dumbass award. Put your coat on, Irish. I need your rifle, even if I don't need you.
Riley looked at the weapon in Welch's hands.
Your carbine working okay?
Not worth a damn. The lieutenant figures we're down to single shot. Kane's BAR is fouled up, too. There'll be no more gun cleaning. The lieutenant's really pissed at himself. Says he knew better than to order us to wipe everything down. He's going down the line, checking every piece.
Check yours.
Riley raised the M1, worked the action, replaced the clip.
Seems okay.
Killian was down in the hole now, pulling on his coat.
Already checked mine. Thought about firing off a clip, but I'd probably start a Fox Company war. Some of these kids are nervous as hell.
Welch patted Riley on the shoulder.
You take first watch. Anything to keep him quiet for a couple of hours.
Welch moved off, dropping low at the next hole. More instructions. His words swept away by the wind. Riley looked up. The clouds drifting past the moon said,
Well, you were right about the snow, I guess. Maybe you're not as stupid as everybody thinks.
Killian curled up tight inside his bag, and Riley knelt, his own bag wrapped around his legs. He leaned the rifle up on the mound of fresh dirt, already frozen hard. He felt a stiff crust on his face, and he blinked painfully, his sweat freezing over every part of him. He wiped at his eyes with the rough sleeve of his coat, a useless effort, dried tears digging into his skin. He cupped his hands over his face, blew a breath, a quick burst of warmth, rough gloves clearing his vision. It wasn't perfect, but he could see down the broad hill, the thin layer of snow barely masking the brush, uneven ground. He pulled the bag up farther, nearly to his waist, touched the rifle, reassuring, one hand pulling the hood of his parka as tight as it could go. But the wind was relentless, numbing cold on his cheeks, more tears clinging in icy flakes around his eyes. He avoided looking upward, but the moonlight told him the clouds were nearly gone. The hillside below him, brighter still.
Fox Hill, November 28, 1950, 2:30 a.m.
They had changed shifts, each man welcoming the opportunity to dig down deep into the relative warmth of his sleeping bag. Riley was up again, the cold deadening his senses as it deadened his arms. If his feet weren't warm, at least he could wriggle his toes, the bag still pulled up over his legs. The challenge again was to keep the tears in his eyes from freezing, the hood pulled as tight as possible, as long as it allowed him to see some part of the hillside below. He took the watch very seriously, had known men in the last war who cost lives by falling asleep or focusing more on their own cigarette than on who else out there might see the glowing ash. The officers drove home the punishment for that, of course, a part of every man's training. Falling asleep on watch was punishable by death, though he had never known anyone to carry that out. More likely, a man who fell asleep might be executed by a stealthy enemy. He had slept for most of his allotted 2 hours, knew that Killian took his watch just as seriously. If a man could not completely trust his buddy, there wasn't much sleep to be had, especially where the enemy preferred a nighttime assault. For all of Killian's annoying traits, Riley had come to depend on him when it counted most, even if Welch seemed to despise the man. He looked down at the dark mound in the hole beside him, a hint of snoring, the only other sound but the blustery wind. He tried to measure the time in his mind, thought, maybe another half hour to go? Hamp will tell me. He crawls around these holes like some kind of rat, popping up when you need him to. He won't let Sean get 1 minute more sleep than he deserves. He stared to the front again, squinted against the wind, the breeze finding its way down his neck. Damn it all, he thought. Who thought climbing up here, out in the wide damn open, was so damn necessary? He looked to the side, saw the shadowy forms leaning out above the edges of foxholes all along the hillside, hidden only partially by the low clusters of brush. We'll lose somebody to frostbite tonight, he thought. There's always one, too stupid to follow orders, who knows better than the brass. And they'll peel him away from his socks and chop off his damn feet. The thought made him shiver, and he flexed his toes again, the regular routine, every few seconds testing just how much protection the sleeping bag was giving him. His mind had begun to wander aimlessly, nonsensical, no distraction but the steady blast from the wind. The image of his wife floated past, but that only made him miserable, all that he was missing, all that was waiting for him, and he pushed hard at that, his brain finally settling on a more obvious misery, the cold. How cold? Where it might be colder? Hate to be an Eskimo, he thought. They live in this crap all the time, I guess. How the hell do you build an igloo? No Eskimos in this outfit. Maybe one of the new guys. Boy, I bet they're having a peach of a time right out of Pendleton. Southern California. Welcome to frozen hell, children. The replacements had continued to come, arriving in trucks even in Hagaru Re, brought along with some of the men from the 1st Regiment. They're here right now, he thought. 2nd Platoon got some of them. There's that one big kid, bigger than Killian. Another New Jersey kid. Caffarino, Caffarata, something like that. Football player, they say. I guess he'll be good if we mount a charge. Killian would be good at that, too. Something a little nuts about big guys. Wonder what the Chinese think about that. They're not as puny as the Japs, most of them. They must think we're strange, all those big guys. Or maybe we just make easier targets. All right, you idiot. Think of something else. He forced himself to stare down the wide hill, blinked through the crust around his eyes, the tears forming a film of ice against his cheeks. There was a hard shout back behind him, shattering the silence, and he spun around, numb fingers on the rifle. He saw now a shadowy shape moving fast, a full run toward him, then up and over, hard footsteps on the icy ground. Riley felt his chest thundering, swung around, tried to see down the hill. Nothing there. Heard laughter. Close by, another of Welch's squad. Holy Christ, you see that? Riley wanted to respond, his hands quivering, a hard grip on the rifle. Another man responded now, closer. The voice of Welch. It was a deer, sure as hell. Got a good look when it jumped. Hey, Pete, you see that? Riley felt a nervous laugh rising up inside of him, the ice in his chest relaxing. Yeah, jumped right over me, scared hell out of me. Yeah, I bet.
Wonder what scared him. A different sound came now. An odd chorus, far back to the left, down low, muffled by the wind. He wanted to ask, but the others were rising up, weapons coming up, questions swept away by the wind. More sounds came now, low thumps, a chattering from a single machine gun. He kept his eyes that way, kicked out into Killian's bag, said,
"Sean, get up!"
Killian responded, the bag shoved aside, rising up, rifle in hand.
"What the hell's going on?"
The sounds increased, a spattering of small blasts, nothing to see, the ground hidden by the curve of the hill. He kept his eyes that way, thought, "Sounds like from the road." He strained to hear, a hint of rifle fire, another machine gun. Streaks of green now sprayed over the crest of the ridge, some bouncing high, impacts of machine gun fire on the hard ground.
"Make ready!"
Riley turned abruptly, saw McCarthy moving up to the foxholes. He pulled his eyes toward the open hillside in front of him, straining to see, the cold forgotten now. Killian leaned forward beside him, his weapon pointed forward, said,
"Come on, you bastards. Try it right here."
McCarthy was behind them now, his voice cutting through the hard breeze.
"There's something going on down below. No word from the captain. No answer on the field phone. Keep your eyes down that hill. If those boys need our help, we'll give it. But the enemy could be anywhere. We need some mortar fire up here. Light up this hillside. Can't raise anybody on the radio."
Riley could hear the anxiousness in McCarthy's voice. Looked back to the left again, staring at nothing. What seemed like muffled mortar rounds, scattered tracers from distant machine guns. He stared hard down the hillside. Moonlight and snow, nothing else there. And now, more fire, closer, from the left, second platoon. Beside him, Killian said,
"They're hitting the captain's CP. They're down on the road. A hell of a lot of good we're doing up here."
Riley kept his eyes to the front, said, "You don't know that. We've got machine guns there, the mortar teams. Plenty of strength. They need us, we'll know."
"What the hell are we supposed to do? Sit up here and wait for all hell to break out? Sounds like it already has."
McCarthy seemed to hear him, shouted,
"Stay put! Hold this perimeter. We see the enemy in our rear, then we hit them. But right now we have to hold this line and keep watch along this hillside."
Riley could hear Killian's grumbling, said, "Easy, Sean. Maybe this one isn't for us.
You want a damn fight. There's time yet."
He kept his eyes on the new sounds from the left. Saw now, far beyond, a flare.
"Hey, what the hell's that?"
Killian stared that way, more flares rising, barely visible in the far distance.
"Oh, hell. I bet that's you damn knee. Illumination flares. Somebody's lighting up the world up there. Something's happening for damn sure. That's not what we're hearing, though."
A new shower of green tracers sprayed past, coming from the saddle. A mortar burst impacted behind them, another down to the right, more tracers. The chattering of those guns swept away by the wind. Riley crouched lower in the foxhole, his eyes fixed on the hillside below. The firing seemed to grow on the left. Another burst of tracer fire, and now a frantic voice behind them, McCarthy.
"They're coming! Give 'em hell!"
Riley gripped the M1 in his hands, a desperate search for targets, for any kind of movement. But the sounds came first, a chorus of bugles, the crashing of cymbals, and now movement down the hill. They came in a line, a dozen men moving slowly, a steady march upward. The machine gun to his left opened, a chattering rattle, red tracers slicing through the men, the line obliterated. Riley stared, dumbfounded, watched another short column farther down, slow progress up the hill, as though no one was watching them. The machine gun opened up again, rifle fire down the line, the enemy falling away, some of those men scampering farther down the hill. The bugles came again, somewhere in the darkness, and Riley kept his eyes toward the sounds, scattered rifle fire coming from the men around him. He yelled at the others in his mind, instinctive,
"Wait! There's nothing to shoot at."
He rose up, aimed the rifle, still nothing. Then a new sound, close below him, a sharp click.
a voice down in front of him, and now shadows rising up, a flurry of motion. The ground around him impacted by grenades, rolling, bouncing. The first blast came to one side, then more, mostly behind him, his reflexes pushing his face down below the dirt. He waited, the grenades silent, heard more clicks and rose up, saw a man a few yards away jamming the potato masher onto the frozen ground, arming it. The click. A new shower of grenades filled the air above him, and Riley crouched low, sheltered by the frozen dirt in front of the foxhole, Killian there as well, loud cursing, his face a shadow. The blasts ripped along the ridgeline, a sharp scream coming from the left, more rifle fire, a brief chatter from the BAR. Killian shouted into his face, "Now!" They rose up together, and Riley looked for targets, but the targets were all around him, men running past, more down the hill, coming toward him. The rifle fire was steady now, every direction, and Riley saw a man scamper straight toward him, a flash of fire from Killian, the man tumbling down, loose grenades rolling into the foxhole. Riley fired the rifle, then again, men running past on both sides of the foxhole, some falling, others pushing past, the bursts from their machine guns silhouetting them. Riley fired again, no aim, the rifle at his chest, his back against the foxhole, his hand shaking, and he focused on one man running across behind the foxhole, his burp gun blazing. Riley pointed, fired, the man stumbling down, rising up again, staggering, then dropping flat. Riley searched frantically, another cluster of men moving past, and he fired again, no aim necessary. The clip popped free from his rifle, and he struggled with stiff fingers, pulled another from his belt, rammed it home, jerked the trigger, fired into a half-dozen men standing tall over him. He jammed the rifle upward, fired into a man's gut, then another, Killian answering with shouts, emptying another clip, the cluster of men tumbling down, one man rolling into the hole, crushing weight on Riley's chest. He yelled, pushed the man off, the man still moving, and Riley reached for the knife at his ankle, his fingers too clumsy, the man rising slowly on his knees, a burst of fire from somewhere close, the man knocked flat. Riley looked that way, saw men crawling, flashes from the other foxholes, a brief gratefulness, silent words. "Thank you." He aimed the rifle again, unsure if it was empty. Killian cursing, then up, firing quickly, another clip. Killian working to reload. From below, more men came in a rush, and Killian aimed downward, 8 quick shots, another clip. Riley pointing the rifle, pulling the trigger, nothing. "Damn." He ripped at a new clip, jammed it in, cursed the gloves, his brain yelling at him to take his time, choose targets, his voice responding, "Too many!" He emptied the clip again, didn't hear his own rifle, the fire blending with so many others. But around him, all along the foxholes, men were screaming, hideous sounds. One more sound, Killian shouting into his ear, "Grenades! Throw all you got!" Riley crouched low, men still running past, saw Killian rise up, a hard throw, another, down the hill. Riley pulled a grenade from his shirt, ripped at the pin, tossed it low, then again, 2 more. Nothing left. "Grab the chink things." Riley remembered the man falling, his load rolling into the hole. He bent low, felt in the darkness, his fingers wrapping on the handle of a potato masher. He wanted to ask, "How do they work?" But there wasn't time. A new line of the enemy jogging up the hill. He jammed the butt of the wooden handle against a rock, heard the telltale click, flung it downward, searched for another. Felt only dirt. Killian had his pistol now, quick blasts into men close by, bursts of machine gun fire blowing over Riley's head, some downward, ripping the frozen ground. He thought of the pistol, but the rifle was there, ready, and he emptied another clip, fewer men close by, some running, kneeling. Riley felt his belt, more ammo, several clips. Thank God. And he waited, searched, saw a man walking up, standing still now, a few feet away, waving to the others, his form outlined by the flashes, the moonlight, the snow, a perfect silhouette. Riley raised the rifle, the blast into the man's head, one more of the enemy tumbling away. He spun around, the fight spreading out behind him, found another shadow, the man standing motionless as though watching. As though nothing else mattered, the M1 blowing a flash of fire into the man's back. Men began to flow back past him, down the hill, pulling away, the fight slowing. A burst from the machine gun to the left. Red tracers spraying back along the ridge, toward the Marines. Down below, the Chinese seemed to gather up. Another line, bugles again, coming again, falling, others driven back, only to return, then driven back again. The firing was continuous, all variety of noises, the spray of the burp guns, the fire from the heavy machine guns, the BAR, more of the M1s and carbines all along the hillside. The screams came as well, discordant noise, men staggering close, still firing, more grenades coming in, streaks of fire from machine guns. Both ways, splashes of color. Riley's brain struck by the sight. Fireworks, like the 4th of July. Chapter 23. Riley. Fox Hill, November 28, 1950. Dawn. He was awake now, stared out over Killian's head, nothing to see, strained to hear past the hard ringing in his ears. The snow had come again, a cold fog settling low on the crest of the hill. Riley sank down into the sleeping bag, gathered up against his legs, tried to flex his toes. His fingers were stiff and stinging, and he looked at the gloves, the bare trigger finger, curled his hand up against his chest. Killian was staring out, the M1 lying across the hard mound of frozen earth, its bayonet fixed.
"Good, you're awake. It's light enough. You gotta see this. We must have killed them all."
"Doubt that."
His words came in a low grunt, choked away by the painful burn in his throat. He tried to swallow, the pain worse, and Killian looked down at him now.
"Hey, you okay? You wounded?"
Riley had already done his personal inventory, no damage that he could feel.
"Don't think so."
"What's happening?" "It's awful damn quiet."
"Pretty damn amazing. There's a million dead Shambos."
Killian paused. "Looks like a bunch of us, too." Riley sat up now, a flash through his brain. "Welch,
we gotta go down the line, check out the others. We made it through, but there could be wounded. Fellas, we need to help."
Killian stared out, nodded.
"I'll go. You keep an eye out. Watch my ass. There's too many bodies out here, and I bet some of them ain't dead enough."
Riley straightened up to his knees, still curling his stiff fingers, gripped the M1. "I got one clip left." Killian rose up higher, leaned his M1 against the side of the hole, pulled out his pistol.
"That's one more than me, old chum. My .45's gotta do. That and the bayonet. Okay, here I go."
Killian was out of the hole now, crouching low. Riley up, scanning the ground. Snow and the bodies of white-clad Chinese. The snowfall was steady, a thick, gray sky, hiding the distant rocky hill. Killian moved off slowly, and Riley looked toward Welch's hole, knew only that it had been off to the left.
"Where the hell are you, Hamp?"
He wanted to call out, breaking the heavy silence, still fought the burning pain in his throat, breathed into his glove. Along the hillside, the other foxholes were mostly hidden, dark places in the snow,